We were at Camp Pinecrest for a week and had a very positive and fruitful week. We had 90 young people at the camp and 59 staff members and two pre-campers, and so we had a very fine week. Encouraging that we can spend a week focusing upon God and His way of life. And it's not just a camp to have fun, but it's a camp in which we're trying to teach a theme and to teach values to the young people. And the main thing that you're doing, and one of the greatest teaching tools that you have, is the example of Christianity in action. What makes the camp a success is not just having a bunch of volunteers there who can help out with different activities, but you have volunteers there who are acting upon the truths that they know, applying the truths that they know. And they're interacting with each other and with the teens based upon those truths and those values. And as a result of that approach, you create something that's unique on earth. You create a model of the kingdom of God. It isn't the kingdom of God. But it is a very positive environment in which you can operate and you can be accepted and encouraged and you can really benefit from it. People aren't picking on you. People aren't bullying you. People are not belittling you. And everybody's trying to work together as a unit. And it's just a small indication of what can be accomplished when God's Spirit prevails and people are yielded to that Spirit and allow it to work in them. Now, to switch gears from that good news and positive statement, we're going to go to dysfunction. And anyway, you might picture in your mind what dysfunction is. Dysfunction is walking into a nightclub, shooting more than 100 and leaving 50 of them dead. That's dysfunctional. Dysfunction is marital troubles that lead to divorce. Divorce is dysfunction. Abuse, verbal, physical, child, spouse, elderly, addictions, alcohol, drugs, gambling, sex, children not neglected or abandoned by their parents. And the question we might ask is, why does God have so little to say in the Scriptures about all of these dysfunctions? God does not have a complete book dedicated to marriage or child rearing. In fact, God has amazingly little to say about those subjects. He does address them, but He does not address them at the length maybe we would like. Noting this fact about God's Word, we might ask, why isn't there more about child rearing or more about marriage? And God said, I already put it in there. And you may be saying, well, where is it? Where are those sections dealing with those particular issues? God is interesting in that He says His thoughts are not our thoughts. He says, my thoughts are not your thoughts. The way I think and the way I deal with things is very different from the way you think as a human being. And so as He says that, it's a heads up for all of us to remind us that the way God thinks of things and does things is not the way we do them often. He's trying to get us to see the importance of doing things His way and to develop so that our thinking tracks with the way God thinks. By nature, we as human beings are all why babies. Why? Why this? Why that? And that's the way we tend to be as human beings. But what's God like? God is a father, and He is a because I said so father. Why should you do this or that? Because I said so. That's generally what it comes down to. And because I said so, Father. And those two real realities put us on different tracks right out of the gate. God is never going to get on the human track. God's not coming down to our level if we don't want Him to. But He expects us to get on God's track. And the question is, how long will it take us to get there? As you think about the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, we find them filled with lots of laws and statutes and judgments that give guidance to a nation or guidance to us as individuals. And many of those laws are not accompanied by a great deal of commentary. And why is that? My hope is that as we go through the sermon this afternoon, you will help to better understand why God has this approach. So God never intended the world to be dysfunctional. That was never His intention. However, that's where we're at as human beings. It doesn't mean that God did not know that there would be dysfunction in society. He knew that. He knew that that was a potential of human beings. And we know this because there are, the scriptures do discuss some of these dysfunctional paths and the destructiveness of certain behaviors. So God knew this. And he knew that it was a possibility. He never wanted it, but he knew that that was the way it was. And one thing that's interesting is we're dysfunctional as human beings. But if you were to be able to see into the spirit world and look at the demonic world as an example, you would see dysfunction that far exceeds anything going on in the human realm. They've had thousands and thousands and thousands of years to be dysfunctional, and they've become quite good at it, unfortunately. So it's not a matter that God didn't understand where man could go wrong. I'm just saying that he never did intend for us to be dysfunctional. It's also hard for us to understand, living in the modern world, that for thousands of years people lived in close communities. They lived in close communities, and multiple generations would live in the same community. The father would be there, the grandfather would be there, the great grandfather, the aunts, the uncles. They would all live in that community. And that's not the world in which we live. There are places where that is the case, but in many parts of the 21st century world, that's not the case. In those communities, the conscience of that community was very powerful, and it forced people to conform. This is how it is. This is the way you're to live, and it helped people to conform to the community standard. And because people are so far afield from that community, there is no guiding force for them as far as how they should live. So as you look around at people that don't have a mother, that don't have a father, they don't have a sister or an uncle that would bring them back to balance or point them in the right direction, it's harder for people to stay on the right track, and dysfunction is much easier to achieve. You know, how many of us live in the same community in which we were born? I was born in North Carolina, moved to California. After California, we moved to Illinois. Then we went to Texas. Then we went to Ohio. Now we're here. We moved a number of different places. But growing up as a young person, when we moved, it was always with a mom and a dad, and there was always that structure there to point you in the right direction. Some people move and they don't have any guidance or direction, and that makes it harder to stay on track. Let's consider some qualities about dysfunction. And the first one I'd like to think about is lying. Most of us are quite familiar with the instruction to always tell the truth. We probably all heard that. Always tell the truth. Why is it wise to always tell the truth? We all know that when you lie, and people begin to dig into the lie or notice inconsistencies in what you've said, then you've got to basically somehow or other continue lying, and you've got to help sustain that lie, and it's a hard thing to do. And all of us have experienced that to one extent or another. We've all lied, and we've all worried about, once we've lied, being found out. And we've been pressed. Sometimes your parents know, I know you're lying. They don't say that, but they keep asking you questions, and you're like, man, I wish they would stop grilling me. I feel like they've got a rubber hose and the lights on me, and they're digging for me to tell them what actually happened. But anyway, we've all been through that. And the thing is, you know, once you begin to tell a lie, usually it leads to another and another and another, and it's very hard to keep it all together. When you always speak the truth, you just have one path. This is the truth, and you don't have to make up anything. You don't have to resist. This is the truth. You don't have to come up with some other story. You just have to stick with that story that you've told, which is the truth. So I use this example because we all are familiar with, we've all lied. We've all tried to cover our tracks. We've all tried to support our particular premise, and it's a hard thing to do. And do we ever stop to realize the difference between a healthy, functional family and a dysfunctional family? Have you ever stopped to think about a functional family and a dysfunctional family, and the difference between them. The normal, healthy family is boringly simple. It's boringly simple, and that's how God intended it. It's boringly simple. In fact, one of the qualities of dysfunction is to be totally bored with normal. There's nothing going on. And it's interesting as you have people that are dysfunctional and there's nothing going on and you're trying to counsel them, okay, follow this path. This is a straight path, a narrow path that will bring blessings to your life and you won't have all this craziness. But they don't know how to live without craziness and they will stir something up or get involved in something else that continues the dysfunction. And that's an unfortunate thing. If you happen to go into Barnes & Noble, which is one of the few bookstores that is still standing, you know, everything's online now. But if you go in there and you go to the section about dealing with dysfunctions, you will find a very large section of books available on everything under the sun, all of the various dysfunctions that go on in society. And, you know, there are lots of authors who write about it because dysfunction is so commonplace. And they have lots of themes to write about because there are so many dysfunctions and permutations of those dysfunctions that they can write about and share with people and try to put them on the right track. So there's a lot that has been written about it. And think about this. Could you sell a book on how to stay normal to a healthy individual? Would they need it? So you don't have a lot of books written on what it is to be a normal, functioning marriage or family or extended family. You don't have a lot of books like that. The number of books dedicated to various dysfunctions has grown larger and larger because we as a society are becoming more and more dysfunctional. So you'll find lots of books on dysfunction, and because people need those books and they're trying to solve their problems and they're looking for answers. But this brings us back to the Bible, because the Bible has all the answers you need in reality. It has all the answers that you need if you follow what the Bible tells you to do. God had very little to say about dysfunction, and the reason why is because his intent was that we would be functional. We would be functional as individuals. We would be functional in our marriages. We would be functional in our child rearing. That was God's intention. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19, where Jesus Christ addresses an issue that was a problem in his time and is still a problem in our time. Matthew chapter 19. And Matthew 19 talks about a particular issue that is still an issue in our time. And what it says about this particular issue opens the doorway into the mind of God about an entire range of things. It's not just the issue that that's being addressed here that we can learn from. It helps to point us God's direction in other issues as well. Matthew 19, in that chapter, the Pharisees were baiting Jesus Christ. So they ask him a question in verse 3, Matthew chapter 19, verse 3. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him, saying to him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" That's the question. Can you divorce your wife for just any reason? And sadly, the Jewish culture had devolved to the point where they would issue writs of divorcement for just about anything. So if your wife did not make your cup of coffee right in the morning, adios. I can get a bill of divorcement and it's over. And it's similar to no-fault divorce where there's no discussion of what the various parties have done wrong and or what they've done right. It's just a matter of doing the paperwork, waiting the allotted time, and it's over. We walk in our separate ways. Verse 4. Christ answered and said to them, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? and said, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." So he says, you know, marriage is to be for a lifetime. A man and a woman is to join together, and they are to become one, not only sexually, but in mind, in body, and in spirit. They are to be one. That's how God established it. And he said, if that's what I've established, don't let any man cause your separation. So the Pharisees heard this, so they pushed back. They said in verse 7, well, if that's so, verse 7, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? So they said, well, that's a good statement, but then why did Moses allow divorce? Why did he do that? And Christ answers them. And he said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, because you're carnal people, not yielded to God and yielded to one another, divorce is a natural outcome of all the conflicts you get into and can't resolve. So he said, Moses allowed divorce, God allowed it, because of the hardness of your heart. And then he goes on to say, he permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. So he said, let's go back to the beginning, to the standard that was established in the Garden of Eden. Divorce was never a part of it. Marriage was, but not divorce. And he says, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. So there are grounds for divorce, but just because you don't like the way she cooks, or she's not as good as the model you started out with, or he's not as good as the model you started out with, those are not good reasons for divorce. There are legitimate reasons, but they're few, and they should be far between. And whoever marries somebody that's divorced, or male or female, it is adultery. And they were just overwhelmed by what Christ had to say about this. So he takes them back to square one. And so they could understand where God originally started. So we go back to the point that I made. God has very little to say about categories of life that fill lots of books. He never intended those things to be, never intended dysfunction, never intended divorce. Communities in the past owned their moralities, and societies played a tremendous role in keeping people aware of the consequences of stepping out of moral boundaries. There was a time when to divorce was a big deal. It was a big deal. You did not divorce. And people sometimes were in some terrible situations because society put so much negative impetus on divorce. Now we've got into the other ditch where it's not a problem at all. But people would stay together because once you got a divorce, you were kind of a pariah from the community. And the community enforced staying with your spouse. So for most of man's history, counseling for various destructive behaviors was not necessary. And, you know, people were able to, you know, they would remain in their relationship, even though it may not have been the best. So God intended Israel, the nation of Israel that he called out of Egypt, to be his book. So it's not that God didn't write a book or express anything about it. He expected Israel to be his book. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that he gave them his laws, his statutes, and his judgments. He wrote Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. He wrote those books for Israel to be a guide to them. And he spelled all these things out for them. And look what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 1. He says, "Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live, that you may live, and as Christ said it, live abundantly, that you may live, and go in and possess the land which the Lord your God, the Lord God of your fathers is giving you. You shall not add to the word which I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you." So I've given you what you need to guide you in how to live. Don't add to it. Don't take away from it. Verse 3, "Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor, for the Lord your God has destroyed from among you all the men who followed Baal of Peor. But you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you are to go to possess. Therefore be careful to observe them." Be careful to observe them. Why? Because this is your wisdom. This is your wisdom. It's how to live. How to interact with me, your God, how to interact with your neighbor, how to interact with your wife, how to interact with your family. This is your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, "Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people." They were to be an example nation to the nations around them, to where the nations would see how they lived and the blessings that they received through their relationship with God and the way that they interacted with one another. And it would be an example to them, and it would draw them to the way of life that Israel lived. Verse 7, "For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him?" They would see that God was in their midst, that God was close to them, and they were close to God, and they were living God's way of life. And they would see from the functionality of their lives and their families and their cities and their kings and whatever else they had, they functioned well, and say, "This is the light to the world." That was God's intention. So God told Israel these things, and wanted them to be his book. But it didn't turn out that way. And one of the things God noted as he spoke to them, he said, "You know, I wish they had the heart to do the things that I've spelled out for them in the Bible, in the Hebrew Scriptures." And unfortunately, they didn't. They did not have the heart for it. So, what we're going to see, if we're faithful to the end and we become a part of God's family, we're going to be there when God invites Israel back into the land of promise. He's going to bring them back to the land. Christ will rule over them, and we as the saints will be there, and we will observe when Israel will finally become the book God wanted them to be. God is going to work with them first and work with them, and they will become a example nation to the nations around. And they will respond, they will begin to respond to God. We get a glimpse of that in Zechariah chapter 8, where it says, "Let's go up to Jerusalem, to the house of God, and be taught." Zechariah 8:23 says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, in those days 10 men from every language of the nation shall grasp the sleeve of the Jewish man, saying, 'Let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you.'" We've heard God is with you. These people that haven't been brought to God yet, they're going to see it, and they're going to say, "We see what you have, and we want it too. Can we go with you to Jerusalem? Can we go up there and learn the things that you are learning, and we can enjoy the blessings that you enjoy at this point?" So they're going to have their opportunity to be the book that God wanted. And what is clear so far is where we live functionally, we don't need a lot of detailed instruction. And that's the first thing to understand in regard to why God has written so little about societal dysfunction. He's already given you the parameters and the instructions that are crucial to functioning effectively as people in this world. There's something even greater than that. As we live our lives of 60, 70, 80 years, we can see out a little way. We can see that God is investing in our eternity. And as we sit here in this fleshly body that has a limited lifespan, God isn't looking at us through that lens of just the here and the now. He's looking at us as an eternal investment. I'm looking at this person and the potential they have to be a part of my family forever. And in that context, the greatest long-term value in our lives is coming to live by faith, to walk by faith. And so that's what God wants from us, is to live by faith. However, as I said, we tend to be why babies. And what does that mean? God goes through our life saying, because I told you so. We're why babies. And God said, well, the reason, here's why, because I told you so. And he says, come on over to where I am. And when I tell you to do something, do it because I told you to do so. And this is not, and we all find that very easy to do it, don't we? You know, when somebody tells you to do something, none of you ever bristle at that, do you? Remember being a child and Dad said, you're going to do this because I told you to do it. You know, you think, thanks, Dad, for setting me straight here. And no, most of us bristled and said, most of us were afraid of our dad, so we didn't say much, but we may have thought it. But that's how we are as human beings. We don't want people telling us what to do. And we develop that why and that opposition to being told what to do very early on in our lives. And I don't think we consciously think of it that way as being why babies or not going along with God. And we ask why for a reason. There's a reason we ask why. We want God to explain it to us. Why? We want you to explain it to us. And why do we want God to explain his laws and why we should do them? Well, we want him to explain them. That way we can hear what he says and we can think it over and decide whether we're going to do what he actually told us to do. Yeah, thanks for that input, but I'm not going to do that. And, you know, when we're asking why, he gives us the explanation, and then we can decide whether we're going to do it or not. We want to size it up and decide whether we want to invest in it. And we want to make the decision of whether we will do it or not. And if we say, well, God, you know, you've told me that, and I know, yeah, that thanks for the input, but I'm not going to do that. What decision have you made at that point? Is God your God? He's not. You've made the decision you are your own God, and you're going to do what you want. And instead of saying, God, let not my will, but your will be done. So God simply removes the explain it to me phase from the equation and says, I will tell you what you should do. Now you get to choose. You either do it or you don't. He tells us, don't sit there and say, why, because I'm not necessarily going to explain it to you. There are things he tells us to do and he doesn't explain it. He just said, this is the best path. I don't have to explain it. I'm your God. You need to trust me and trust that what I've told you to do is going to end up being for your benefit. So coming to the place of believing from the heart that God, when he says, this is the way, that's all we need. That's the point that God wants us to reach. And to trust him that if he tells us to do something, it's because it's the best thing for us, even though we may not fully understand it. Coming to that fundamental understanding is worth more than all the knowledge found in all the books that have been written about marriage, family life, child rearing, and society, or will ever be written. When you accept God said to do it this way, and say, I think he has my best interest at heart. That's what I'm going to do. When you make that decision, it makes life a lot easier. It makes it a lot easier. Consider the angels who rebelled. The angels were created, and they were perfect spirit beings. And they lived in a perfect world until a portion of them said, God, I don't like what you do, and I think I can do it better than you can. And do you think someone who has not come to the place of being capable of living by faith toward God will be any different? So if you don't trust God, you're not going to do what God told you to do. How many thousands of years is it going to take for you to reach that point? It's doubtful whether you'll reach it. How long will it take before you come to God and say, I think I can do it better than you? That's basically what Satan said. Interestingly, Satan was at God's throne. He was a covering cherub. He got to hear every message that came into the throne and went out from the throne. He heard it all. He was aware of all those decisions. And after listening for who knows how long, he finally said, "You know what? I don't think you're doing it right. And I think I can do it better than you. In fact, I've got a lot of other angels that feel the same. And we're going to take over. And we will run the universe." That's basically what Isaiah and Ezekiel tell us. And God said, "Nice try, we're not doing that." And he put down their rebellion. So God right now is in the process of getting us to the place where we can live by faith. Faith is basically understanding what God has said and doing it. You read it, you understand it, and you seek to implement it. Have you ever stopped to consider that faith is a two-way street? That we have faith in God, but God also has faith in us. It's a two-way street. It's not just a one-way deal. As you look at Genesis chapter 22, where God tells Abraham to go sacrifice his son. All right? God, by asking Abraham to do that, you may not have stopped to think about it, had great faith in Abraham. He had seen how Abraham had operated, and he said, "Abraham needs to be tested in this way in order that I can be assured of where he stands, that he will always put me first." So God had faith in him that he would meet the test. And you know what, God? There was nobody in the universe that was pulling for Abraham more than God. "I want you to pass this test." He didn't want him to fail. He wanted him to pass the test because of the wonderful result that would occur. And when Abraham was willing to sacrifice Isaac upon that altar, and he was ready to plunge the knife into him or slit his throat, whatever the procedure was, God said, "Stop. Stop. I don't want your son. But I know that you will put me first. You will put me before the most precious thing that you have, and that is your son Isaac. I know you'll put me first." He said, "Now I know." And when God knows that we have explicit faith in him, you know what the product is? He has faith in us. And as we meet the test, then he says he's met the test and he has confidence in us and he has faith in us. It was that day when Abraham met the test that he said, "The promises that I made to you are no longer conditional." There are no longer any conditions. No conditions. The conditions are gone. And all the promises I offer to you, Abraham, from this point forward are unconditional. I don't care how dysfunctional your family becomes, the promises will be delivered. And we living in our nation are reap the blessings of Abraham, even though we don't deserve them. Now, we can be taught the kind of faith or trust that doesn't need a raft of explanations by positive and negative means. You know, we can learn what walking in faith is all about. A positive means of learning what it's about is, you know, you might close your eyes and think about your time as you've been a part of the church. Think about it and think about if you, in your experience over the years in the church, you have been with people and known people who conduct their marriage as God instructed. Can you think of someone who's had a marriage that was done right, done the way God laid it out? You can probably think of people who have brought their children up well. They were polite, they were hardworking, and they sought to practice the religion as they were taught. We can find people who will teach what we call biblical ethics to their family, as God taught those ethical values in His Word. They taught their children, this is the right value, this is the way that we live. And we can see a family that you've known, that and it has existed from generation to generation to generation. There are thankfully people in the church that their grandfather was in the church, their mother and father were in the church, and so on down the line. You have the example of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph, all individuals who passed on the faith to the next generation. You see the fruits in the elders of the family. You see the fruits in the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren. And we see that very thing at camp. Children that have grown up in the faith, their parents were in the faith, their grandparents were in the faith. And that's a most encouraging model that we can look to and rejoice in. It's a positive education. And you can take that inequality of life that people live consistently, and you can see it modeled from one generation to the next. It's natural. It's a natural process that God has established. So there's not a lot of teaching that goes on. There's not a lot of instruction we find in the Bible. We see people taking the truths that they've learned and modeling them, putting them into practice. And I'm fascinated by the number of times that God has a statement that follows a simple equation. I, God, have given you simple instructions. You simply need to go out and do them. And the end result is that life is going to be good. That's what he says. I've given you the instructions. You need to learn them and do them, and your life will be good. That's all God says. That's a simple formula. So let's look at a few places where he gives us that formula. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 4 and look at verse 39. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 39. God said through Moses to Israel, he says, therefore know this day and consider it in your heart that the Lord himself is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. There is no other. You shall therefore keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord your God is giving you for all time. Do these things, practice these things in your life, in the life of in your marriage, and in the life of your family, and you will be blessed. You will be blessed. And pass them on to the next generation. Let's go to chapter 5, verse 16. Chapter 5, verse 16. This is the commandment. It says, honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be long and that it may be well with you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. It is the first commandment with promise. And there are lots of volumes of books dealing with family dysfunctions, problems with mothers and fathers, problems with children toward their mothers and fathers. But you notice God simply says, honor your father and your mother as the Lord commanded you that it may be well with you. It doesn't say honor your mom or dad if they were good to you, if they were good parents. It doesn't mean that and sadly, some of us have had some real tough situations to deal with. That's not to negate that. But it says you're to honor your mother, your father, your parents. And even if they've done things that are reprehensible, you still recognize them for their office. They are your mom, they are your dad, and you seek to honor them the best that you can. And part of learning to be able to honor them after maybe things have not gone well, forgiveness is at the heart of it. Forgiveness and letting it go. And you forgive. You let it go. It doesn't mean that God's not going to hold them accountable for what they did or didn't do. He will. But for you, you can be freed from all of the upheaval and anger and problems that come your way because you can't let it go. God says, let it go, forgive them, and let me take care of it because, trust me, I remember everything. And if there's a time to deal with it, I will deal with it in the time that is best for them. But as you learn to honor your mother and father, and even though they don't deserve it, but you're seeking to practice what God has taught you to do, you're walking in faith, because He doesn't tell you, why should you do this? He doesn't tell you you need to do this and explain all of the benefits that will come from it. He said, if you do this, your life will be long. You will have long life and you will be blessed. He does tell you there's a benefit to it, but you know what? You never get to know what that benefit is until you do it. It's that simple. And God's not simplistic in that He knew that, unfortunately, human beings would be abusive and people would be neglectful and people wouldn't do the job that they should do. But God says, let me take care of it. He asks us to exercise faith to do it, even when we don't understand or we can't figure out, well, why should I do this? God said it. Do it. God isn't saying if you understand, as I said, then do it. No, He said do it because I told you so. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 29. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 29. Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments. Israel was a physical people. They did not have the heart to honor God and to keep His commandments. But we, as Christians, have God living in us. And as a result of God living in us, He's given us the heart to keep all of His commandments, that it may be well with them and with their children forever. That's the outcome that God wanted, that it would be well with them, and it's well with you, and it's well with them, and it's something that is self-replicating. It brings benefits in your life, and as you exemplify it and pass it along to the next generation, they benefit and are blessed by it. That's one of the things we try to share with the young people, is that they are called. Because you, as parents, are in the church, they have the opportunity to be called and to be a part of God's family forever. The door is open to having a relationship with God. Chapter 5, verse 33. You shall walk in all the ways which the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess. And God's not finished with what He has to tell Israel. He picks up in chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. He says, then, now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God, to keep all His statutes and His commandments which I command you, you and your son and your grandson, all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. He said, you'll be blessed. Your children will be blessed. Your grandchildren will be blessed. And you will have a relationship with me. Verses 17 and 18. Verses 17 and 18. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, His testimonies and His statutes which He has commanded you. And you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you, and that you may go in and possess the good land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. So God made these great promises that if they would follow them, they would have a good life and that they would enjoy the benefits of the way of righteousness. As you look at the books on dysfunction, a basic element of each book of the books is the pain that results. But where did the problem begin? Where did dysfunction begin? It's not inherent in the system in which we live. Dysfunction came because of sin, because somebody decided not to follow God's statutes and judgments. So He's pointing you back to the statutes and judgments, that if you will follow them, dysfunction will cease. If you wanted to eradicate the dysfunctions we see in our society, we could do it if we would implement what we're taught in the Scriptures. If we began to live that, it would make all the difference. You'd see it. I can verify that because in going to camp and for 1 week having 150 people come together and generally follow God's model, not perfectly because we're still human, but following that model, you can create a positive atmosphere in which wonderful things can be achieved. So it says, if you do this not just for a week, but for 52 weeks and 1,000 years, the results are going to be amazing. Going to be truly amazing. So we've looked at a cluster of verses that tell us, do what I tell you to do, whether we are talking of laws, commandments, statutes, or judgments. And you know what's going to happen if you do? It will be well with you. You can count on it. It will be well with you. Question. What's not well with you? What's not well with you? Your family. Your friends. And how did it become not well? How did it become not well? The answer to that question is not going to be by living like God said. It's going to be that you haven't been living like God said. And once dysfunction gets on a roll, the consequences multiply and spread, like leaven spreads in a lump of dough. And God didn't intend the world to be dysfunctional. As he told the Pharisees, Moses gave you a bill of divorcement because of the hardness of your heart. But that was never my intention from the beginning. My intention is that you would marry one person, be one with that person, and it would be a lifelong relationship. Oftentimes, as you go through the Old Testament, we see communities that are tightly knit, and then those tightly knit communities, to try to buck the social trend, there was no place to go. And that wasn't all bad. You know, if you look at various writers that lived in small communities and everybody gossiped about the other person and all of that, they felt that that atmosphere was constricting. And they wanted out. They wanted to go to the cities where they could do what they wanted. And that's a very common theme with human beings. So, if you move out of the social network that was set up there in Israel, then you were free, but there was no net to catch you. And that's the way it was for thousands of years. Where was the main, you know, and if you look at America, where was the central location where people socialized up until about the last 75 years? Where was the main place that they functioned and they had their social functions? It was their church. You had a community church. That's where you would have socials. That's where your friends were. You would come there. You would attend church there. You would be buried there. It was all part of that life. And that's the way it used to be, but it's no longer that way, especially in the first world in which we live. God is far more concerned that we learn to take him at his word without having to explain himself. I said it. Just do it. Then that he should write everything out so that we can understand it. Because the product is faith, and faith has an eternal value. With these things in mind, let's look at Romans chapter 1, verse 17. Romans chapter 1, verse 17. And Romans chapter 1, helps us to understand a basic principle which is fundamental to what we're talking about here today. We're going to look at Romans 1, verse 17, because it's applicable to what we're saying. It's applicable to why it is that God does not spend more time giving us detailed explanations of what he commands us to do. To help us to fully understand, let's begin in verse 16. Paul here says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power to God, of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek." And then he says in verse 17, For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. So the verse that the portion of the verse that says the just shall live by faith, it has three components, one of which we've already covered. As an axiom, God says the just shall live by faith. We find that in the Old Testament in several different places in the Minor Prophets, and we find it three times in the New Testament. So if God's repeating it, I would think it's an important principle, the just shall live by faith. So we know as a position that God says the just shall live by faith, and that's what I've been talking about in the second portion of the sermon up to this point. But what he says before that is twofold. The righteousness of God is revealed. That is, it is being revealed. It's something that's ongoing. The righteousness of God is being revealed. And it should be understood that the righteousness of God is in the process of being revealed. It's ongoing. We're revealing it. It's being revealed in our lives, hopefully. And it's the point he's making is revealed in the cryptic phrase from faith to faith. So we see three things. The just will live by faith. We are the just. We are those who have been justified through the blood of Jesus Christ. And we are to live by faith. The righteousness is in the ongoing process of being revealed. So we're growing. We're maturing, and hopefully we're putting righteousness on display by the way we think and the way we talk and the way we interact. And the vehicle of that revealing is faith to faith. So if we see this, what does he mean there, that righteousness is revealed from faith to faith? What is he talking about there? And it's a little bit hard to understand. But what he's saying is, first is that the principle, as a principle, faith builds upon faith. Faith builds upon faith. For the first generation members of the church, that is a more graphic outcome. They were not in the faith, didn't know what the faith was all about, and then God called them and opened them their minds to the truth. They began to understand it and practice it. They began to walk in faith. They became justified and they began to walk in faith. And there was a point where, as I said, God called those of us who are parents out, and we sought to pass along the truth to our children. And our children, they didn't have to be called out of the world. They were already in the faith, if they wished to pursue it. And that's what we want for all of them. That's why we talked about a camp, building a relationship with God, which begins with God's calling. And we wanted them to very clearly understand God is calling them. They have parents in the faith, so they can come along in the faith and they can walk by faith. So when we stepped out and we began to practice God's way of life, what did we do? We all had to confront, probably first and foremost, the Sabbath. We had to go tell our bosses, I can't work this day. What? You never had this issue before. Just started, and you had to tell them, I can't work on the Sabbath from sunset to sunset. And they probably said, well, we just meet once a month. Can you get a dispensation for that one time a month when we have a meeting? No, it's every Sabbath. Oh, that's extreme. And you wondered when you went in to talk to them, am I going to be able to keep my job? And we've all had to face that from time to time. It's part of the life that we live as Christians, and you step out on faith. So you go in there, and you're going to talk to your boss, and your feet are hanging over the edge there at the cliff. Is this going to work out or not? You don't know. So you jump off. God, save me. And some of us have stories where that's taken place. Some of us have said, heard the words, you're fired. Find another job. Don't let the door hit you in the butt. Get out. We've had that happen. Never fun. And then you're wondering, well, God, I did what you told me to do, and I'm looking for work. But he knows. And, he helps us find the work that we need. So we have to step out on faith. And as you look at tithing was a tough deal. I know my dad did not come in the church for a long time because he said, look, we're struggling to make it on the income that we have. And if we start tithing, there's going to be even less. So eventually He did it. And they were blessed. And those of us who have taken that step to begin tithing and say, you know, God told me to do this, so I'm going to do it. And he says, I'll bless you. But he doesn't tell you how it's going to work out. And for most of us, when you do the math, it never works out. But when you say, I'm just going to quit doing the math and I'm going to do what God told me to do and I will tithe. So if I make $100, I will tithe that $10 on it. And I'll do it because God told me to. And what happens is, as you do that, that's an act of faith. And it helps, it encourages you to, again, when you're in, the need comes up, to act in faith. From faith to faith. From act of faith to the next act of faith. And you see, God saw me through, He'll see me through again. God's with me. God was with me before. He's going to be with me now. And I can do this. It's doable. And you build faith and strengthen that faith. You don't think that, you know, we talked about before I left for camp about David walking into the camp of Israel and they're battling in a battle of the Philistines and Goliath is challenging them. See, David was already walking in faith. He had faced the lion, the bear, and other issues in his life in faith. So he walked out there to take on the giant in faith. And that's what we learn to do as well. And we build the ability to do that by practicing it day in and day out, meeting the test of faith and doing what God told us to do. We might boil faith down to right and wrong. We have faith in the right of God. How do we prove God's way is right? We step out on faith and we find out. So Paul is saying the rightness of God is being revealed to us on an ongoing basis through every act of faith that we must exercise. The rightness of God is being revealed to us on an ongoing basis through every act of faith that we must exercise. The more of them we exercise, faith to faith, the more obvious it to us that God's way is right. And there is no other place to go. And what does it produce? It produces a person who has chosen to live by faith. We see that Romans 1:17 is not just a religious phrase, but it is a story about our lives. Because we've all been there. We all had to step out on faith. And we sought to pass on our faith to our children. And we want to see our faith passed on to our grandchildren. And we build faith brick by brick, block by block, and build our relationship with God. So remember, we read all those places in Deuteronomy that where God said, keep my laws, my commandments, my statutes and judgments, that it may be well with you. God said it. God meant it. And we have to pick a position. Will we do what God has told us to do? Will we walk in faith? Next time you ponder the question that I raised at the beginning, why is there so little detailed instruction about dysfunction in the Scriptures? One reason is God never intended the world to be the mess that it's in, but it is what it is. And secondly, then consider the inestimable value of faith and its impact on you now and for all eternity. We, as we practice faith, exemplify it for others and we pass it on to others. So faith is passed on from faith to faith.